You're listening to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like geography, the visual arts, performing arts, storytelling, and literature. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by the artists behind There Must Be Other Names for the River, Dylan McLaughlin, Marisa DeMarco, and Jessica Zeglin. This online art installation hosted by the University of New Mexico Art Museum guides visitors along the length of the Rio Grande, where they hear the songs of singers emerging from points along its 1,800-mile length.
I want to just start by talking a little bit about your collaboration. We were commenting how well you all work together as a group, and I guess that's bound to happen after collaborating on a project after 2 years. But your group was bigger. Did you have this same group of singers? You've done this 3 times, 3 performances. Is that correct?
We've done 2 performances for the public, and it was 6 singers. And one of them switched out because somebody wasn't available. Those performances were pretty far apart in time, too. You're kind of relaunching the piece. And then we also did, with the original 6 singers, we went down to the river and recorded the piece there. And then as we were conceiving the physical installation for the UNM Art Museum, the idea was to form informal choirs at each of those points and to meet up with those people all the way from the headwaters to the mouth and record them singing just that point. And so we had formed the Albuquerque Choir in early 2020 and had them all come to the river, and they just are singing the Albuquerque data because it was the beginning of collecting that choir audio, which was going to be part of the physical installation. And then, of course, when the pandemic happens, it's no longer a good idea to go traveling to those places to meet up with big groups of people. So that's kind of the trajectory. The 3 of us are the composers and artists and organizers and conceivers of the project. And we enlist the help of different singers and musicians to make it happen.
Earlier, we talked how you had all met in Nina Elder's art class, right? Is that how you all ran into each other?
We knew each other from school. We were all graduate students in the UNM art department. And then Jessica came to me and was like, we're going to do this kind of mini class. We were hoping you would do it with me and Dylan and Nina. But we already knew each other from school.
We talked about this a little bit in the first segment that you all had some audio and music background. But aside from that, on this particular project, is there a bit of a breakdown in people's particular strengths? Jessica, it seemed like you ended up being kind of the number cruncher.
I think we sift tasks according to what people feel comfortable with and excited about doing. I'm comfortable with being patient, sifting through data, which I don't know if that's a skill or not, but yeah.
So are there other places where one of you sort of took more of the lead in a particular aspect of the task list?
All the time.
Jessica did number crunching, did research, did recording, did conceptualizing of the score. Her handwriting is the font for the piece. Has the best handwriting of the 3 of us, we agreed. Also, as we were developing the concept of the piece, we all did that together. There's so many facets of this piece because it is a public-facing piece where we're really trying to kind of say something specific and get the message out far, that there's a lot of components you wouldn't normally think of in an art project, right? But I would say that artistically it was grown from the 3 of us, and then we're breaking off these other component tasks. Jessica's also a great emissary. Like, if we have to explain to someone why we're going to stand around and sing for 40 minutes, I'm like, I really think Jessica should go do that. Because Jessica gets along with everyone. Yeah, Jessica's the nice one. She totally is. I was trying not to say that directly, Dylan, but yeah, you're right.
I think that there's been a lot of moving parts to all of this work. And I think the interesting thing about having navigated a very successful collaboration, one is I think we all have deep backgrounds in collaborative processes in our creative work. So collaboration, I think, is not new to any of us, and we all do it and have been doing it for a long time. And I think that as far as some of the project organizational aspects, it's about delineating tasks or delegating tasks. Gosh, it's like overwhelming to think about how many things we've done, you know, like all the budgets and all the modifications of the budgets we put together, all these time schedules, composing emails that are going to UNM organizers. All that being said, the interesting thing about this collaboration is that it all goes through the three of us. And yet we're also all really constantly having utmost faith in each other. Whoever chooses out of the three of us to do the thing is doing it because they're probably the best at it, or for whatever reason can get it done. And then so the other two of us would be like, thank you, you're the best at this. I don't think I could have done it because I didn't have time, or because I'm going through something that's keeping me from being able to focus on this right now, or because I'm teaching at the moment, or because XYZ. Like, it's been an incredible year to be working on a massive art project like this. Making a large-scale art project like this in the midst of a global pandemic has been really, really complicated, difficult, and also inspiring and grounding. We've almost met weekly for the last year. And so then how we like choose who does what just kind of comes naturally out of who can do this. Like, Marisa managed, facilitated, scheduled all of the recording sessions with each of the musicians for the final recordings and mastering of the sound piece that you hear when you go to the website for the main exhibition. That in itself, it's a lot of conversations around facilitating those relationships, those friendships, setting up the physical space, all the technical aspects of recording music and mastering and finishing that music. I mean, there's just an incredible amount of moving parts to all of this.
I think this is where collaboration is so strong. I wouldn't have been able to make this piece on my own. There's no way. It wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't have the complexity. It wouldn't have the depth. And so I love that we started initially from a collaborative place with the three of us. We expand that collaboration as often as we can through the framework of the piece to the musicians and the singers and the choirs, and also to the people who are contributing their tributary voices. Collaboration allows us to have this complexity and nuance that is just more challenging to do on your own.
I think actually the whole notion of producing all of this during the pandemic, it's been a story for a lot of the people we've been talking with over the last year. But a detail I'm sort of curious about is the recordings. Those were done, though, for the physical installations. How did you actually have the musicians do the recordings then? I mean, you weren't in a studio, I presume, together. So how are you doing that?
Yeah, we actually did COVID-safe studio recordings. So we had initially intended to do them all at KUNM radio station, but the station is, of course, closed. And so we ended up using a couple of spaces at the UNM Arts Lab. And basically what I did is I set up all the gear, got the conductor set up. The conductor is telling you, like, as the years are passing, it's like a video so that you're in the right place in your score as you're performing. So that all they had to do was, like, hit play on that and then had them come into the building at a time when there's not anybody there and go into the room on their own and set everything up. So it's kind of like this funny process where before they came, I was testing the gear by running back and forth between two rooms versus the way you would usually do it, which is where you're set up in different rooms and communicating. So it's kind of running back and forth, got everything at good levels. Then they came in, you know, and we're in two different rooms with a piece of glass between us and doing a lot of visual communicating or trying to yell to each other somehow. Or I think a couple of times I like wrote something on a piece of paper and stuck it on the window and just tried to create a COVID safe recording situation using some gear that KUNM lent me from the studio. So we had really nice microphones and everything that we would have. And then just really trying to be mindful of everybody's space, putting a lot of time between the performers, like many days between each session, and making sure there's like hand sanitizer and that there's water available for them that I haven't touched with my physical hands, you know, maybe touched with a gloved hand. Like, we were really careful. And honestly, it's some of the only live music I saw during the pandemic was watching them record. And it was something that kept me kind of going in some ways, because as we were talking about, we all miss live music so much. So it was nice. And it was for them some of the only performing or music that they've made in this time, right? It was in October. a little bit before the election, actually.
That's actually kind of really beautiful. I mean, the idea of these people doing such intimate, important recording work during the pandemic almost makes it more special. I'm also curious, there's been the live performances. Maybe at some point there will be a sound installation at the UNM Art Museum, maybe. But right now the website is the place. I mean, I have to say, having looked at a lot of interactive art, I really like the interface. I like the simplicity of it. I mean, I could put a four-year-old in front of it and they could push buttons and the way the map scrolls. Someone programmed and developed that. Is that one of you three, or is there someone who did all that programming for the website for you?
We worked with a web development organization based out of Santa Fe called Mindshare Labs. And that was another element of collaboration in which we had extensive design conversations about, well, this is what we want. There's like a few layers about how we were approaching the work because we had already designed the physical space with the physical considerations that were informed by lots of conceptual conversations and relationships and holding space for lots of complexity. And so we already had that. We had already had months of those conversations. And so then it became time to, how do we communicate this to this development team who is tasked with the technical aspects of how do you actually build this out? How do we program this to exist in a virtual space? But under the guidelines of all the considerations that we had as far as how we want people to experience it, what was important to us aesthetically, all of those considerations.
You did the website since you were making the shift from planning a physical installation. Was there anything that you weren't able to do with the website that you were hoping to do with the physical installation, or vice versa, where going online gave you new opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if we've really sat down and had specifically that conversation, but I think that was a conversation that unfolded kind of over the course of all of those months. And it was honestly something we talked about all the time, which was, what were those core considerations that we had made? What was our initial vision? And that was kind of one of the things that came out of our collaboration, was that it was always kind of a constant check-in of what was our initial vision and what are we trying to do? And if we are making a change in something, how is it still able to communicate that initial vision? How do we design it in a way that still has all those attributes and characteristics and experiences that we were initially designed for? But that being said, lots of things changed that wouldn't have been the case otherwise. Like the online contribution forms, being able to host everyone's music contributions as the tributaries kind of on its own separate website, the call-in phone number, you know, how does a website function? How do people use the website? How can we make this work as accessible as possible? I mean, that was one of the things that the website did, is that it kind of opened up this conversation of like, well, we can reach a lot more people potentially online than would have been able to make it into the physical space. Also, that show as a physical space probably would have lasted a couple of months or something and then would have come down. And now we have this virtual space that in theory can just stay there and continue to be added to. So that's one significant difference, is that now it's a space that potentially can continue to evolve well beyond what we imagined it to be.
I think as you're talking about it, I forgot how hard that process was. Like, I haven't thought in a little while about that rough transition from thinking physical installation versus virtual. What I was afraid would be missing is that we had intended for this to be something that the viewer, the audience, experienced in their bodies and physically in space. In the installation, we were planning to use these very directional speakers so that there were moments where you would hear just what one point along the river, or there were moments where the whole river would emerge and kind of be part of the experience. So losing the physicality of it is hard when we're talking about the embodiment of the river and hoping that other people can start to feel that embodiment in themselves as they're taking the piece in. But I would say that the surprise was the tributaries kind of do that. When I hear the audio that people have submitted, it's like I can feel them in space. I can feel them standing next to the river or in their backyard or at their house or whatever, like telling me this story. And I didn't know that that would work out that way.
I came into it kind of cold and I was pretty blown away by what I saw.
It's really powerful work.
Dylan, Marisa, Jessica, thank you so much for taking time out of your hyper busy schedules to talk with us about this project.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And if you would like more information about this project or to interact with this project or to contribute a tributary to this project, you can visit the website othernamesfortheriver.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.